Hello, I'm Michelle Hanratty. Thank you for listening to Sound Optometry. Just a reminder that you will no longer receive a CPD point by listening to this episode of the podcast. But if you subscribe and listen to the most recent episodes of Sound Optometry, you can gain CPD points. I hope you enjoy this episode of Sound Optometry. Hello, welcome to Sound Optometry, the new podcast from Docket that provides high quality continuing education and training for all UK registered optometrists. You can gain one CET point by listening to this podcast and completing the short exercise on our website, docket.info. I'm Michelle Hanratty. I'm an IP optometrist based in the Midlands, where I've been working in high street practice and in hospital practice for over 20 years. With case studies and in-depth conversations each month, we're exploring the topics that matter the most to us optometrists. And this month, we're going to discuss flashes and floaters, the symptoms that may or may not lead to retinal detachment. We all know that sinking feeling when a patient mentions those symptoms. We know we'll probably have to dilate, and we know that in most cases, we will find nothing of concern. And we also know that our clinic will run behind for the rest of the session. So despite knowing what to do, we don't always handle it very well though. Retinal detachment is one of the most common reasons for fitness to practice complaints to the General Optical Council. This is also reflected in the figures from the Association of Optometrists, which show that in 2019, retinal detachment featured in 16% of the cases that resulted in legal action against their members, making it the second most common cause of complaint after glaucoma. To help us navigate through the potential minefield of managing flashes, or photopsia to use the technical term, and floaters in this episode, I'm joined by Steve Lash, consultant vitreoretinal surgeon, and Roshni Kanabar from the Association of Optometrists. So Roshni, were you surprised to find that retinal detachment is a leading cause that optometrists need legal representation for?
Yeah, so when I had a look at the figures, I was surprised that out of the five most common conditions that result in legal action, which are cataract, glaucoma, retinal detachment, tumour and incorrect prescription, retinal detachment was actually the second highest in most of the years following glaucoma, with the exception of 2012, 2013 and 2017, where it was actually the highest.
What about you, Steve? What's interesting here is that you were an optometrist before you were an ophthalmologist. So if you remember back to those days, can you remember ever feeling uncertain about whether or not to dilate someone?
I remember those days very well. 1994, locum optom, trying to earn enough money to put myself through med school. Yeah, no, I do remember them well. But 20-minute testing, pressure on getting through patients. And I'm well aware that ophthalmologists sit in these clinics where everyone expects to wait, and the world of optometry is very, very different. So I just remember the sort of difficulty with knowing that if you decide to dilate, you throw your entire schedule out. It didn't stop me dilating, but it definitely is a barrier.
So Roshni, what is it about flashes and floaters in particular that make them a leading cause for complaint?
Well, we all know that feeling when a patient presents in your practice with those symptoms. You've got a fully booked clinic. You know it's going to make you run late. The patient then needs an urgent dilators fundus exam and will need to probably arrange a different way of returning home. It might be that you're already running late in your clinic, or it's your last appointment. And as an optometrist in practice, it's quite challenging to manage patients with these symptoms and also advising your support staff that you'll be running late. In our experience at the AOP, the patients with symptoms of flashing lights and floaters, they mainly fall into three different categories. So the first category is those that don't actually have a teror detachment. The second category would be that those that actually do have a teror detachment. And the third category is those that don't have a teror detachment yet, but later go on to develop one.
Okay, so even if a patient doesn't have a detachment and their optometrist has done the dilation and checked that the fundus, the patient still sometimes can complain. So it really is not just about what you do with the patient, it's about how you communicate with the patient, isn't it? It's about what you tell them and the onward information that you send them away with.
The communication is really, really crucial, because the most common complaints that we actually see is from the patients that don't yet have a teror detachment, but later go on to develop one. And so I think in that situation, your communication is absolutely key. And these patients should be advised that although at the moment you don't have a teror detachment, you are still at higher risk of developing one subsequently. And therefore, if your symptoms change or you experience any more symptoms, here's what you do, and maybe giving a leaflet or some written information as well.
Yeah, I was just going to say that, you know, when someone presents with a PVD, it's reckoned that there's approximately a 10% chance that they're going to have a tear. And these patients tend to present on average, it's around day 11, but it could be anything from day 1 to day 30. And it's actually the ones that present on day 1 with symptoms that are the most likely to have a retinal tear or a detachment. So you're absolutely right. What you communicate and obviously what you write in the notes. So I always warn patients about the three Fs, the flashes, the floaters and the fading vision. I explain what's happening and say it's a process, so it doesn't happen in one go. And should you develop new flashing lights, new floaters or any shadows, please phone.
Thanks, Steve. So let's supposing we want to deal correctly with the patient. Let's sort of have a run through of that. The first step is to dilate the pupils in most cases. So Roshni, how would you prepare the patient for this? What would you say to them to manage their expectations about being dilated?
I actually like to explain a little bit about the anatomy of the eye to the patient in a simplified form so that they understand why the test needs to be done and what is actually going on inside their eye. And they're more likely to agree to have the dilated fundus examinations, because we all know sometimes patients are like, oh, I don't have time, I've got a meeting. And it's like, no, you need to have this done ASAP because there is a chance that this could be potentially sight-threatening. And until you've actually checked inside the eye and had a look, you don't know. So that's what I like to do in practice.
Thanks, Roshni. So, Steve, when you suspect a retinal detachment, what signs are we looking for in the eye?
I would certainly start with a vision and a relative afferent pupillary defect, an RAPD. They'd be both very useful. And then move on to the slit lamp, and you're looking into the anterior chamber for cells. You do sometimes get a low-grade inflammation with a detachment, especially a more chronic detachment. The other thing to think about is the pressure. So often the pressure is lower with a detached retina. I have been caught out before with a Schwartz syndrome, which is where RPE cells clog up the trabecular meshwork and you get a very high pressure. So it's definitely worth looking in the anterior chamber. And then without grabbing for your superfield at this stage, I would then have a look in the anterior vitreous. So push the slit lamp right forward. You can probably get to the junction of the anterior third with the posterior two thirds. And just have a look there with the beam at a slight angle, and then get the patient to look up and down and back to the centre again so that you stir the gel up. And then you're looking for pigment cells in the vitreous, the so-called tobacco dust. And if you see that, then there is a good chance that there is a tear. If you don't see that, it doesn't mean they haven't got a tear. So it's useful when it's present, but not so when it's absent. You can also sometimes see the posterior hyoid at this stage as well. So this appears as a sort of greyish sheet, and then behind it is completely black. So that would be useful for a PVD.
So Roshni, so can I come back to the sort of the record keeping element here? So presumably, if we've done all of these tests, what's it imperative that we record on the record card, bearing in mind that most systems now, record keeping systems, are quite limited? So you've got either a computer screen that doesn't give you much option, or you're writing on a record card that's got really tiny boxes. So what's really imperative to record at this stage?
I think that taking a really good history from the patient is really important. So when did these flashing lights start? How long have you had them? How often? I think that is really, really important. And I think you've really got to ascertain the finer details about their symptoms. I look at a lot of records, and I think that it's really important that you record everything, basically. So you don't have to write the full advice that you've given to the patient, but just write that you have given the advice. Write down your management, tests that you've done, the drops that you've used. And I know it's tricky with certain computer systems. There's only a limited amount of space. You have a certain amount of characters that you can use. It just needs to be on there to say what you've done, what you've advised. It's really common to find that a patient's recollection of their symptoms as set out in their actual complaint is quite different from what the optometrist has recorded within the clinical notes. And this really highlights the importance of good record keeping, because a fitness to practice panel will generally prefer the written records of an optometrist over the verbal recollection of a patient.
Okay, so if we were to record something around what we've done from a clinical examination point of view, it's really important to note down what technique we've carried out and what our observations are, even if they're negative. Actually saying that you've looked for it and not found it is actually very powerful from an evidence point of view, isn't it?
that's really, really important, because a lot of the records that I look at, the optometrist may not have recorded something, and often they say, well, I did do the test, but it was negative, so I didn't record it. And I mean, not recording something means you haven't done it. It doesn't mean you've done it and it's negative. So even if Schaefer's sign is negative, you must write Schaefer's sign negative, because that shows that you've actually done the test, you've had a look for it, and it wasn't there. Because otherwise, how do we know if you've done the test or not?
And presumably that the same applies for if you've got access to imaging as well, say fundus images and OCT images. So if you normally have access to those images in practice, but for whatever reason the system was down that day, if you haven't been able to view the images at the time that the patient's with you, it's important to record that as well, isn't it?
Yep, that's really important. You can just say viewed fundus photos or within normal limits or looks healthy or something like that. Just make a comment so that we know that you've actually viewed the images, or if you haven't been able to view the images, unable to view images because of this. Or if you, for example, view the images at a later date. So often what happens is I might view the OCT maybe not on the same day, but maybe a bit later. If it needs a lot of sort of analysis, I might make a new record or go back and write the date of when I'm editing it and write viewed OCT today, looks okay, or whatever. But you can't really go back and edit the record unless you put a date on and explain why.
Okay, thanks, Roshni. So if there is no sign of a tear or a detachment, how do you think you need to communicate that, bearing in mind that it doesn't negate the risk of it happening again in the future? Perhaps, Steve, you could come in here.
Yeah, I think I would explain to the patient that the process of the jelly coming away from the back of the eye is a process. It doesn't happen in a single go. In fact, we now know from OCT images that there are four stages of PVD. So we've all seen the sort of lifting around the macula but attached at the fovea, and then bridging over the macula with separation at the fovea, and then eventually coming away from the disc, and that's a full PVD. So normally sort of motion to them and show them an eye and say, look, it's come away here, but it may come away there at a later date. And I say over the next month, be particularly aware of any flashes, floaters or fading vision. Just do something so it sticks in their mind that if symptoms progress, they should contact. And I write that down.
Thanks, Steve. Roshni, we've already discussed what we should be recording when we examine a patient and when the patient's told us about their symptoms. But what do you think we should record when we decide that we are going to refer the patient?
Well, first of all, note down what you see on the record card, write your referral letter, explain to the patient, this is what I've seen, this is what I'm going to do. Keep really good records. If you are a resident optometrist in the practice, you will obviously know your referral pathways. If you're a locum optometrist, that's a little bit more tricky, but the practice support staff are there to support you, and they may know there might be a folder in the testing room that you can have a look at.
So Roshni, locums quite often feel vulnerable, as you've said. They may not know the local protocols. Is there any particular advice that you can give them about recording information like this for their own use? For example, is it worth them keeping a mobile clinical log? Because there are commercial applications available for this, aren't there? And is there any issue with GDPR with having a log like this?
When I was a locum, I used to have like a little notebook, so you wouldn't write their name because obviously you're taking that log home with you and it's leaving the practice. The AOP actually have a locum log book, and you can use that to document any patients that need any follow-up tests. Ideally with patients with symptoms such as flashing lights and floaters, they would need to be investigated the same day. But for some reason, if they cannot be, let's say it's your last appointment of the day and you're not able to do a dilated fundus exam, or the patient is driving and you need to book them in the following day in the morning, for example, the AOP actually have an internal referral template on the website, which means that you can write the patient's ID number, you can write what's been done, what needs to be done, and you can pass that on to the resident optometrist. You can leave it for them or give it to the practice manager so that everyone knows what's going on and you're not sort of worrying and trying to leave little bits of notes everywhere for the next optometrist that's going to see the patient.
So really that internal referral is helpful because it passes the responsibility over to somebody else. You do a handover to somebody else by paper, don't you? Which is good because obviously you don't want to be carrying around patients' personal details such as phone numbers in order to check that they've actually followed up on your advice. Thank you. You're listening to Sound Optometry with me, Michelle Hanratty. Every month, we'll be exploring the topics that matter the most to us optometrists, and that's where we want to hear from you. If there's a topic you want us to cover or a question you want to ask us, email us at podcast@docket.info or tweet at soundoptometry. Back to flashes and floaters. I'm joined by optometrist Roshni Kanabar from the Association of Optometrists and Steve Lash, consultant vitreoretinal surgeon. We've covered how to correctly maintain notes and history, and now we'll be moving on to referral and treatment. So Steve, why is it important to get a suspected detachment seen to quickly?
It is very important, and here I'd like to redress the issue of macula on and macula off, and this idea that macula off are not urgent and macula on are urgent. In an ideal world, we would treat every detachment before it goes macula off. But in the real world, we see a high percentage of patients who are already macula off. And in fact, often when the macula comes off, especially in slow chronic detachments, patients lose their stereopsis. And this is what alerts them to the fact they've actually lost vision in an eye. So I've seen many people who've lost significant vision without realising it until the centre comes off. Really, from the time that macula comes off, the clock is ticking on final visual outcome. And we are aware that there's a step change down in prognosis at around day 3 to 4. And then at after day seven, it's very unlikely to get good vision back after surgery. In terms of protecting the macula, obviously, if you've got a supratemporal detachment, which is within the arcades and close to the macula, that's very urgent. Whereas if you had an infranasal detachment, that's unlikely to progress to the macula very quickly. If you've got a non-PVD tear, so a small round hole in a myope, in a young myope with no PVD, that's unlikely to progress very quickly. So all the different sorts of detachments will progress at different rates. But fundamentally, you want to assess and say, what is the chance of this macula coming off? And if the macula is off, you want to get them in urgently to get them treated as quickly as possible.
So, Steve, I think you've actually preempted some of my questions, because I was going to ask you, what are the consequences if there is a delay? And actually, does the location of the tear or the detachment matter? So what you're saying is, if it's a superior tear, it's urgent that day to casualty. And if the macula are on, yes, it is urgent because you want to get them seen before the macula comes off. But if it's off, it's still urgent, because if you delay it too long, then the visual prognosis goes down rapidly.
It really is. I mean, after day 3, chance of getting driving vision back are failing fast. So from a patient's perspective, MAC-offs are, I would say, more urgent than MAC-ons.
Right, okay. If someone does have a retinal tear, how would that be treated, first of all?
The treatment of a retinal tear is much more straightforward than the treatment of a retinal detachment. So having identified the tear, we would then have a discussion about, obviously, the option of doing nothing, which is probably more than half of all tears are going to progress to a detachment. And a horseshoe tear is high risk, so I would be very keen to treat that, especially in the presence of acute symptoms. And I would be talking to them about applying some laser to that tear. So the vast majority of cases are treated at the time they walk in and walk home straight away afterwards. Very occasionally, we might choose to use cryotherapy if the view is not so good. Perhaps there's been a minor vitreous hemorrhage. Cryotherapy will always require an anaesthetic block, and is a little bit more sore for the patient.
Okay. So it's fairly straightforward if someone has a tear. What about if someone has a detachment? What kind of conversation would you have with the patient then?
So the first important thing is to explain to the patient what will happen if they choose to do nothing at all. So I would say to the patient that without surgery, the detachment is likely to progress until all of the retina is off and they've lost all their sight. The other thing I would say to them is that once the retina comes off in its entirety, there is a risk of the eye becoming soft and shrinking back in the socket. So they could end up with a painful, shrunken, blind eye. Having had that conversation, I would then move on to, well, what can we do about it? And I would explain the retinal detachment surgery to them.
So after explaining the worst case scenario, if they do nothing, you would then go on to reassure them and tell them about the visual prognosis if they do go ahead and have surgery.
Absolutely. And, you know, most people are pretty scared about having eye surgery under a local anaesthetic. But in fact, I usually say to them that most of what they're scared of is not going to happen. So I've never had someone pull their head back or screw their eyes up as you would if someone naturally came at you with their fingers towards your eye. But this just doesn't happen in surgery. So I'd explain that it's done under a local anaesthetic. They're laying down on a couch with a drape over their eyes, so they don't see very much going on in theatre. The anaesthetic is applied through a little injection around the side of the eye, which is usually painless. And then we proceed to surgery, which lasts anything from about 20 minutes up to perhaps an hour.
So once the patient's set up ready for surgery, what actually happens when you actually go in to actually do the detachment surgery itself?
So there are two basic ways of doing a detachment. One would be an internal approach, which we would call vitrectomy, and the other would be an external approach, which would be a buccal surgery. We do very few buccal surgeries these days. With the vitrectomy surgery, we go onto the inside of the eye using sutureless techniques. And the aim of surgery here is to remove the jelly from the eye, to remove that traction on the retina, then to reattach the retina using an air bubble, and then to stick the retina back in place using either freezing therapy or laser to get the retina to stick onto the RPE. And because this takes some time, we would usually put an air bubble or a gas bubble or even oil in the eye to give it time to stick properly.
So once a patient's had this kind of surgery where you've put a gas or a bubble in the eye or oil in the eye, are there any restrictions as to what they can and can't do after surgery?
Absolutely. So with any air bubble or gas bubble in the eye, they cannot see and they cannot fly. Air would last a week, a short-acting gas would last 2 weeks, and long-acting gas is 5 weeks to 8 weeks. So they cannot see and they cannot fly, and the bubble gets smaller, rounder and lower over the period of time that it's going to be in the eye. An oil bubble we would tend to use when we're sort of planning to fail, so in complex detachments where we want to get control of the eye. Now, the advantage of an oil bubble is you can fly with an oil bubble in the eye, and you can see, although not very well. You get a very hypermetropic shift with an oil bubble. The problem with oil is it requires another operation to remove it.
So if someone was on holiday in the UK and it required urgent surgery, it would be a while before they could go back to their own country, for example, unless you used oil.
Absolutely. And then in terms of posturing, it really depends where the tear is. So if the tears are in the top half of the eye, what I would generally get them to do is on day one, so on the day of surgery, I tend to log roll people. So I roll them, whilst in theatre, we roll them onto their side to hang their retina from the disc to try and avoid folds, and then eyes down for the rest of the day. And after that, I would require no posturing whatsoever.
Steve, just to finish off, if a patient has had successful retinal detachment surgery, but one of the risks of that surgery is the development of a cataract fairly soon afterwards. If a patient does develop a cataract, is there anything in particular that an optometrist needs to be aware of or bear in mind before they refer on for cataract surgery?
Yeah, I mean, the classic cataract vitrectomy wise would be a nucleosclerotic cataract with a myopic shift. So they get that dense central nucleosclerosis and quite a rapid progression in myopia. I did operate on one of our staff members who ended up getting 6 or 7 pairs of specs in the interim. I think one pair would be sufficient, and then when you get a shift, then you need to have cataract surgery. Of course, the main issue is not going to be loss of clarity, it's going to be anisometropia.
Thanks, Steve. And finally, do you have any words of wisdom before we part ways?
I think for me, most importantly, please don't categorise macular off as non-urgent. I think these are more urgent in many ways than macular on detachments. So refer quickly for macular off. I think that would be my number one take-home message.
And what about you, Roshni?
My final words of wisdom. So number one would be communicate, explain to them what you're going to do, what's happening with them, keep them informed. The second point would be record keeping is absolutely crucial. The third point I would be to manage the patient effectively. And this can often be a combined group effort with the practice support staff, managers and the optometrist. And most importantly, don't panic. It's crucial that you remain calm so that your patient is not panicking as well.
That was Roshni Kanabar from the Association of Optometrists and Steve Lash, consultant vitreoretinal surgeon. If you would like more information about dealing with flashes and floaters, go to our website, docket.info, and search for sound optometry to find the reading materials. Listening to this podcast and completing the short exercise will gain 1 CET point covering communication, standards of practice, and ocular disease. Next time, we'll be discussing binocular vision challenges in routine practice. We'd really appreciate it if you help spread the word about the new podcast, tell your colleagues to listen, or subscribe to the series so you don't miss an episode. And remember, if there's a topic or question you want us to cover, then let us know by emailing podcast@docket.info or tweet @soundoptometry. I'm Michelle Hanratty, and the producer is Izzy Clark. Thanks for listening.
Hi, Izzy, the producer here. One more thing before you go. We want to know how you liked the podcast and what topics matter most to you. Complete the survey linked in the episode notes or on the course page, and you'll be entered into the prize draw to win £250 in Amazon vouchers.